Hello, everybody. This is Chris with the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. Today's episode is brought to you by Freshly.com. Quality meals delivered right to your door. Get $40 off your first 2 weeks. Go to Freshly.com. Let Freshly do the cooking for you. With Freshly, you can choose from a variety of delicious, fresh, and healthy chef-cooked meals, which are delivered right to your door. All you have to do is heat for 3 minutes, making mealtime and cleanup easier than before. You know, if your family's like mine, things get a little hectic, especially during school and sports seasons. Freshly will send you freshly cooked meals to your door, not frozen. They'll be fresh. Put them in the refrigerator, heat them up, and they are amazing. They do not taste like TV dinners. They taste like real home-cooked meals, and they're delivered directly to your door. You pick your meals from the constantly rotating weekly menu of 30-plus different gluten-free options. All of your meals are prepared and cooked by professional chefs and delivered fresh, never frozen. No shopping, no chopping, no cleanup. Freshly chefs take care of the meal prep for you, from perfecting the meals on your weekly menu to sourcing the best ingredients. And there's nothing artificial about it. They use only high-quality ingredients to make fresh meals. No artificial preservatives or colors, no added refined sugars, and no gluten. Just nutrient-rich food you can feel good about. Heat, eat, enjoy. Save an hour on dinner by heating one of their fully prepared nutritious meals in just 3 minutes. What are you going to do with all that saved time? Let them do the shopping, the prepping, and cooking for you. For customers like you, Freshly has a limited special time offer. 2 weeks of dinners cooked by their chefs for $40 off. It's normally $56.94 per week. Go to Freshly.com today. Actually, go to try.freshly.com for the special offer, limited time only. try.freshly.com. try.freshly.com. You know, some people think that I tell my story to get praise or to, you know, be on the news or be on shows like this. And you don't realize how difficult it is to become so vulnerable and to open your family up to that scrutiny. But I know how important it is, because when a news segment airs, I get hundreds and sometimes thousands of comments and messages and people who are suffering in silence, and they tell me how much inspiration they get. And so I don't want my struggles and everything that I've suffered to be in vain. Like, I really believe that God gives people struggles and trials to overcome them and then to be that hope and help to other people.
And a Safford City Council member is suspending his campaign for Congress.
A Safford City Councilman has suspended his campaign for Congress after suffering a heroin overdose.
His name is Chris Taylor. You may actually know the name very well. It's been very publicized here in the Arizona media and the Arizona press.
Chris Taylor was running for the Republican nomination to challenge Democrat Tom O'Halloran this November.
And tonight, Chris Taylor says he is seeking treatment for substance abuse.
We first met Chris Taylor in 2017 as we dug in on the opioid problem plaguing the eastern Arizona city of Safford.
In a previous campaign ad, Taylor opened up about his struggles with opioid addiction after two tours in Afghanistan.
Taylor, a veteran who fought off addiction to open his own treatment center, was poised to be the success story for Safford. But he went backwards as old demons resurfaced last week. A relapse that resulted in an overdose. In a statement to suspend his congressional campaign, Taylor was very direct, saying, quote, "I'm not going to hide from this. I'm not ashamed of what happened. I wish to sincerely apologize to the amazing people who have supported me. It's a haunting reminder of a dark past that will always be looking over the shoulder of a bright future."
All right, everybody. Welcome to the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. I'm your host, Chris Taylor. And believe it or not, this may be the last time you see me standing. I'm not standing, am I? I'm sitting. I was about to say this last time you might see me alive, but that's kind of morbid. I'm embarking on my 35-mile trek down the mountain, down the 10,000-foot mountain this evening. Well, tomorrow morning, about 4 a.m. is when I will wake up and get driven up to the top of the mountain and dropped off, and where I fend for myself for three days at max. So anyway, I don't want to jinx myself, so I kind of stopped myself there and said, basically was going to say that, you know, I might break my leg or something, but I'm sitting down, so you wouldn't know that. You would never know that. I could hide that from all of you. Anyway, welcome to this episode of the Come This Far podcast. Because of recent events this last week, I'm going to continue down this path of the issue with law enforcement killing unarmed individuals in this country, and some of the other issues that I see that we just have to stop tiptoeing around because we don't want to offend law enforcement. Look, you can be the most pro-law enforcement person in the entire world and still see what's happening is just simply unacceptable. And we just want better. And I'm not even going to bring race into this episode because the way I see it and the way that my experiences are, that race is not the driving factor in most of these situations. Now, racism, implicit biases certainly play a major role, and I'll get into that a little bit. That's one of the very first topics that I attempted to broach many, many months ago. Well, several months ago when I first started this podcast, I believe, was the very first episode. It was right after George Floyd was murdered. And that's when I started the podcast that week. And I put out an episode called Muted and Listening and tried to talk a little bit about what implicit biases are and how they play a factor. And man, there was so many negative comments from people saying, I don't have implicit biases. I don't have any biases. I don't see color. No. The fact that people won't even humble themselves enough to say, you know, maybe I do have some implicit biases. You know, maybe my brain is telling me to do things that I really don't want to react in such a way. And the analogy that I always go to is, you know, if you're in Chicago or New York City or, you know, fill in the blank, Phoenix, Houston, you know, whatever, big city or any city, and you're on the subway or the L train or the bus or whatever public transportation you're taking, and it's late at night, it's 12, 1 o'clock in the morning, and you're the only one on that train, or that, you know, there's very little people on the train, and an individual walks in, a young black man in his 20s, muscular, dressed in such a way that the clothes are a little bit more baggy, maybe a hoodie is on, you know, whatever the case may be. And you're going to sit there and without having any racism in your heart or any malice towards anybody, you're going to take notice of that individual and you're going to be a little guarded. Maybe you can hear his headphones blaring Tupac or NWA, F the police or whatever, right? Now suppose at the next stop, a well-dressed business casual man in his also in his 20s, a white man, comes on dressed in khakis, a nice polo shirt, clean cut, clean shaven, nice short haircut. He gets on, and you can tell, you know, he's dressed nice. He looks educated. He, you know, whatever the case is. And you know, as a white person, are you gonna have the same reaction sitting there? Can you honestly tell me that you're going to, you know, not have any difference in reaction at all, even if it's subconsciously? That's preposterous, and you know it is. And so the fact that you people will say, well, won't even admit that that might be the case, if that could be the case, just points to what the actual root of the problem is, right? Now, in this same analogy, suppose that I told you that first gentleman, the black, mid-20s, muscular build, baggy clothes, listening to menacing hip-hop music, gangster rap, whatever you want to call it, okay? He just came from a hip-hop concert. He is a Harvard graduate, lawyer even, or doctor, whatever, fill in the blank. He's very educated. He makes $165,000 a year. He's going from downtown Chicago to a suburb where his family, where he has a wife and young children. The second gentleman that I said, he's more of what you would call a Ted Bundy type. He just got done raping 4 women that week. He killed 2 of them. The other 2 are locked up in his basement. See where I'm going with it? See what I'm saying? Now, as a police officer who 95% of your interactions throughout your career happen to be with, you know, people that you may see as thugs. Maybe your beat is in a predominantly African American community. Are you honestly going to say that you're not going to react differently in a situation? Say, take the Dante Wright situation. We're going to talk about that a little bit today. Are you going to treat Dante Wright differently if that was him than say that second gentleman that's dressed in business casual, a clean cut, charismatic, good looking, young, white male? And if you say that you wouldn't approach the situation based on those 2 characters any different, you're lying to yourself. And therein lies the problem. There's implicit biases that you know, and it comes to a basic issue in this country with profiling, with biases that we have that is beaten into us culturally, that is really no fault of our own. It's just what we are indoctrinated with, and stereotypes, the reason that they are used is because often they are true. Let's just be honest. But that doesn't mean that they're always true. And that doesn't mean that you can base your action or reactions on those stereotypes or on those preconceived notions about something, somebody. Okay? That's probably one of the most basic issues that I see in American policing. Okay? And you can't, the first step to solving any problem is admitting that it exists. And so we in this country are not even able to have a rational discussion surrounding that phenomenon of implicit biases or even explicit biases, meaning you know you have the bias. You don't want to, but you know you have it. How do you remedy that? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. But I do know some steps that you can take as a person to remedy those types of biases. And the first one is admitting that, man, maybe I do have some biases that I don't know about, and I want to explore those. And there are ways, there are studies done, there are programs, there are, you know, very smart people developing ways to deprogram your mind, to root out your biases and to you know, figure that kind of stuff out. And so I would say that kind of programming, that kind of policies, that kind of studies or pilot programs or whatever you want to call it should exist first in police departments, particularly high risk police departments in major cities where the boiling point seems to be very near. You know, Minneapolis area is just a powder keg. One thing is going to set off a chain of events now, starting with, I'm going to butcher the names and I apologize. I think it's Castile, Mr. Castile. He was shot and killed in 2014, I believe, in Minneapolis. And then, of course, George Floyd, and now this last week, Dante Wright. Talk a little bit about that situation really quick right now. Oh, man, where do I even start with this? Taser, taser, taser. Oh, I shot him. When I saw that, I just don't know how to react. I really don't, because unless Officer Potter, former Officer Potter, now Kim Potter, is an Academy Award caliber actress, I believe that she made a mistake, an unfathomable mistake, in my opinion. Especially one to be made by a 26-year veteran of the police force. She has been a police officer, a sworn police officer, an active duty police officer for 6 more years than Dante Wright was alive, meaning she was on the force for a full 6 years before he was born. And for the last however many, she has been the, you know, a training officer, a senior officer, training other officers. And I'm gonna kind of go point by point on here, because I have been engaged a little bit on social media on this case, on this issue. I don't really like to get involved in that too often, but when I see some things, it's like, I have to speak up here a little bit, because it's the same, it's a different book, same old story, right? We see a situation like this happen. There is a crowd that immediately rushes to the aid of the officer, usually a white officer, usually a white male officer, in this case, a white female officer. And I call them the, no matter what you do, back the blue crew, right? They're going to, no matter what happens, no matter what the police do, no matter what the cop in question does, they are going to unequivocally, unconditionally, back the blue no matter what. And you see them come out in droves right away. And in more egregious situations, like George Floyd and Officer Chauvin, which, by the way, the defense just rested their case. This is the worst time for a situation like this other case with Dante Wright and Officer Potter. Excuse me. The worst possible time that this could happen, right as the trial is in full swing of Derek Chauvin, that obviously changed the country, changed the world, nearly a year ago now, 10 or 11 months ago. It's just unbelievable, man. And the fact that this could happen anywhere in general is horrible, but the fact that it happened in Minneapolis, and I know it's a different police department, it's Brooklyn Center, but looking at the map, it's basically part of Minneapolis. It's basically a neighborhood of Minneapolis. You know, those of you who live in Arizona, you know that when we talk about Phoenix or the Phoenix area or California, you know, you talk about the you say Los Angeles, but there's all of these cities that are or municipalities that are basically one big city. This is like, you know, Tempe and Chandler and Scottsdale and Glendale and Gilbert and Mesa. You know, we call them all Phoenix, Peoria. It's Phoenix, right? So when something like this happens, the news is going to say, oh, here in Phoenix, Arizona, right? There's other municipalities, there's other police departments, but it's literally 10 minutes away, 10 miles away, where this incident happened from where George Floyd was killed. It's the same county. It's the same city, basically. Of course, we've seen people take to the streets, and I don't blame them one bit. I have seen them be a little more measured than in past, and that's probably because they usually at this point, after a few days of rioting or protesting, the people that aren't affiliated with that movement, the people who are there to take advantage of the breakdown of society, who claim to be with Black Lives Matter or whatever, they're really just opportunists there to loot and stuff. That's when they usually come in and give the peaceful protesters a bad name. And it's there's a lot of right-wing media that won't differentiate between the two. And it's clear any journalist on the ground can say, in whether it's Ferguson, Missouri, whether it's Minneapolis, Minnesota, whether it's Kenosha, Wisconsin, wherever these major things have happened and riots have occurred, there is a clear time between when actual protesters who are there for a good cause, exercising their constitutional right, they're peacefully protesting, they're not violent, they are hurting and they are angry and they are broken and they are sad and they are distraught and they've reached a point where they just can't do it anymore. They just can't sit down and be quiet anymore. And then, of course, you see things deteriorate where people from other cities and other states and other wherever come in and try to blend in with those peaceful protesters. They are the ones that become violent. They're the ones that loot and burn and destroy. And then, you know, usually the conservative right, whether it's the media or people, they want to lump them all in together and, you know, it's ridiculous and we should be better than that. But I don't know really where I was going with that, other than the fact that I started saying that these protesters seem to be, you know, a little bit more peaceful, and you can tell that they're just hurting. How could this happen? How could this happen again here in this state, in this county, in this city, with everything going on? You know, what's going to happen if next week, when the jury deliberates in the Chauvin trial, and they come back with a not guilty or a hung jury or whatever? I just can't imagine things getting any worse. back to this case with Kim Potter. As much as I want to give her the benefit of the doubt, as much as I do feel for her, because it's obvious that she immediately was remorseful and she, you know, I just can't imagine being in her position right now. I do feel for her. I'm a human being. I feel empathy for her, sympathy for her, whatever. But look, people say, well, all he had to do was comply and he would have been fine. He's a criminal. What they do, and this is the same thing that happens in all of these cases, is especially when the officer's actions or mistakes or whatever you want to call them are so egregious that you can't, in good conscience and good in your right mind, defend the actions of the officer. So what do you do? What do they do? They immediately stigmatize and criminalize the victim, and they victimize the officer. It happens all the time, even with Officer Chauvin, not as much to the degree, because when you have your knee and on the neck of a man for almost 10 minutes after he's in handcuffs, 5 minutes of which he's not even breathing anymore, it's kind of hard to victimize that guy. But they're sure as hell able to criminalize and demonize and stigmatize the hell out of George Floyd. And they're doing the same exact thing to Dante Wright. There's been many things of disinformation that I want to approach right now. I have researched this extensively. What happened was they pulled him over. It's unclear why he was pulled over, a minor traffic violation. He was asked to get out of the car by the other officers. Officer Potter, who was the superior, who was the supervisor of the other officers that pulled him over in the first place, came on scene, ran his license plate, his name, realized that he had a warrant, a misdemeanor warrant, mind you, for failure to appear. Now, this is where it gets tricky. People say, well, he's a felon, and he ran, and they were afraid that he was reaching for a gun, whatever, okay? But you can't have it both ways, right? You can't say, well, she did actually mean to tase him, and she actually shot him, but it's okay because he's a felon. He had a warrant, and he ran. So play stupid games, you win stupid prizes, right? That's the one of the sayings that I hear a lot. What I don't understand, though, is that so Officer Potter, the 26-year veteran, this is another thing that I've seen people confuse, that they see the 26-year veteran thing in her title and the way they describe her, and they say, oh, she's 26 years old, she's a young police officer, she's a rookie police officer, made a mistake. No, she's 50 years old. She's been a police officer since she was 22 years old. She's been on the force for 26 years. She's not 26 years old. She's 48 years old, and she's been a police officer for 26 years. She's had a badge and a gun and a taser for 26 years, okay? And not only that, she is the department's lead training officer. She is tasked with training new officers. She is tasked with conducting the ongoing, continuing education, continuing training of the entire department of the Brooklyn Center Police Department, which I believe has about 49 or 50 sworn officers. So not a huge department, but a pretty decent sized department. In Hennepin County, which I imagine they'd have some overlap. Most big counties like that have agreements in place with other municipalities within the county. They help each other when they can, when the situation warrants. And so they're probably often in and out of Minneapolis, St. Paul, maybe even. I don't really know that area too well. But I know it's the same county. So the fact that it's only a 49 officer department, but look where it's at, right? It's a pretty decent sized city and department, and within larger Minneapolis Twin City area, Minneapolis St. Paul area. My point being that I would maybe have more leniency for a day one officer right out of the academy on the job for a week in that situation, may have the adrenaline dump and everything else that comes with it in the situation like that. And I'll talk a little bit about that in the next breath here. But I would be more lenient or be more forgiving, I guess, or understanding of that happening to a 21-year-old, bright, bushy-tailed young officer right out of the academy who's all geeked up on adrenaline, pulls his taser or her taser, or meaning to pull the taser and pulls the service weapon and shoots the victim. I could see that. A 26-year veteran who's been a police officer for 26 years, who is the department's lead training officer, who's in charge of all training within that department. Here's my take, and I don't have any inside information. It's just, look, this is the only way that I can reconcile this in my mind is that, okay, she's been an officer for 26 years. 18 or 19 of which she's probably been in a training officer role. So she's had underlings. She's been a superior. She's been a veteran officer. What often happens with people like that is they already have a huge power trip because they're an officer. They have a badge and a gun. They can basically do whatever they want. But then they have another tier that they've climbed in the department. They've started to rise the ranks. There's people under them. Now there's officers, male and female, that are looking to you, to her, Officer Potter, Kim Potter, to provide wisdom and training and experience. And that's a training officer. You know, they're calling her ma'am. They're you know, the same with Officer Chauvin. He was sir to those other officers because he was their training officer. He had much more time on the force than them. So that power trip gets magnified and multiplied. And so in my mind, I'm thinking, you know, the only way that somebody would make that mistake, or even begin to make that mistake, because when you're an officer or a soldier or somebody that's putting yourself in a situation like that to protect and serve other people, you train so often, you get so proficient at your tasks, that your drills and your tasks and what you have to do, that it becomes second nature. You've heard the term muscle memory. There's a reason that the taser is in most departments by policy is holstered or mounted on the weak side, most often pointed the opposite way. So the only way you pull it is by reaching all the way over with your strong hand to your weak side and pulling the taser. They've made them yellow, bright yellow. They're plastic. They weigh a lot less than a huge Glock. A Glock 17, which is one of the biggest Glocks that they make, a full-size Glock pistol that most officers carry. Are they shaped similar? I suppose, but so is a baseball and a basketball. But you wouldn't mistake one for the other. In her case, she had it on her weak side, and she had it not backwards facing, but front facing. So she would have to pull it with her left hand to come out with it. So the fact that she pulled her from the right hand and had the gun in her hand for multiple seconds, 30 seconds to a minute, I have to go back and look, and she's pointing it at the guy saying, taser, taser, taser. And then not after she shoots him and kills him is when she realizes she made a mistake. I just can't fathom it. When we come back from this break, I'll break it down a little bit more. We'll talk about Chauvin. We'll talk about some other situations. Listening to Come This Far podcast. All right, everybody. Welcome back to the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. I'm your host, Chris Taylor. And before we took a small little break, we were talking about Kim Potter and her horrible mistake, and how it's just unfathomable to me how someone like that could do what she did. Now, what I was about to get to was the fact that the only way that I reconcile this in my mind is that as the training officer, as the 26-year veteran, as somebody who other officers look to for answers, for training, for mentorship, for, you know, whatever the case may be. And I don't know anything, I don't have any inside information about her or anything like that. But the only way that I can reconcile this in my mind is that oftentimes when people get into those positions, they grow complacent. They think they're above having to drill and train and do the things that create muscle memory. Training like that, training fight in firearm proficiency, training in tactical situations and decisions and tactics and procedures and techniques and all of this that where you know situations where life and death matters are happening all the time, whether you're an officer or a soldier or whatever. It's not like riding a bike where you learn how and then that's it. You just can pick it up whenever and you're fine. It's not the way that it works. In situations that soldiers put themselves in and cops put themselves in and firefighters put themselves in or find themselves in, you damn well better be well practiced and trained and not just initially, but on a continuing basis, a weekly, daily, monthly, whatever basis, where you're doing the same things that you did in the academy or right when you were a rookie. Because when you grow complacent, you lose that muscle memory. You just like if you're not lifting weights, say you're a bodybuilder and you're lifting weights for 2-3 years straight, you're so bulky and big and you have these muscles, right? You stop doing that. You stop working out. You eat horribly. Are you going to keep that same physique? No, you're not. Trust me, you're not. And it's the same way with your memory and your muscle memory and doing things like drawing your firearm versus your taser. And the way she had it on her belt was that it was facing forward, just like her firearm. Her firearm is on her strong side. She's right-handed. She pulls her right hand. It's a big black firearm, a Glock 17, a full-size duty pistol. Very heavy and bulky. Okay. On the left side is her taser. Yellow, bright yellow, weighs considerably less. Are they similarly shaped? Yes, they are. Are they holstered similarly? Yes, they are. But they are nothing like each other. The taser is one of the most well-known, less lethal methods that officers have to protect themselves and others without escalating to the point where somebody needs to lose their life. So that's why we have tasers. Before, I don't know when they became very popular. It seems to be around 2000 or 1999 or 2000, somewhere around then is when it was when the company taser kind of just blew up and every officer had one and every officer wanted one and everybody, you know, it was the cool thing to do to have a video of you getting certified on the taser, because it's famous that to certify on the taser, you have to be tasered yourself or tased yourself. I've never quite known what tense to use or what tense of that word to use. Or do you get tased or do you get tasered? I don't know. But that's the big thing, right? And it happens in army units as well, special operations units. We get tased all the time. We practice on tasers, you know, just as a cool thing, fun thing to do. I don't know. I've been tased many times. It's not fun, but it's way different than a firearm, right? And it's supposed to be. The first generation of tasers were more similar to firearms. They were all black. They were all this and that. The ones that appears that those officers in Brooklyn Center had were the bright yellow ones that are shaped differently, that are holstered differently. That, you know, it's just a different situation. And the fact that, you know, she drew her pistol from her right side, she had it in her hand for like at least 30 seconds, maybe longer. She was pointing it at him. Not only that, but she was flagging the other officer. And flagging means when you're pointing the barrel of your firearm and your friendly forces are between the threat, the bad guy, and you. And you're pointing your gun. She's flagging her partner multiple times, which is a huge red flag to anybody who's had any tactical training whatsoever. So that's right there in my mind. How could she be the lead training officer for that department? Maybe she's just complacent. Maybe she's put herself above all of the other officers. She doesn't have to do the drills that seem to be mundane and seem to be, this is no fun. We do this all the time. Why am I doing these drills where I'm drawing my weapon and then drawing my taser? And why am I going through these stupid scenarios all the time? It sucks. Somebody with authority, somebody with 26 years on the force, who's training people who weren't even born when she became an officer, I could see how she would sham out of those and say, I got to do paperwork. You guys go do this. You know, you see it all the time. It's one of the things that irked me so much in the fire service when I was a certified firefighter for over 5 years. There was many firefighters on my department that had been in service for over 25, 30 years. And every training week, every week we train, have a formal practice and training scenario. And it was only the guys with 5 years or less that were conducting the training. Whereas the other guys with any more time than that were sitting in lawn chairs, smoking and drinking and acting like they were in the VFW or American or, you know, the Elks Lodge or something. You lose your proficiency fast, very fast. It's why I go, you know, it's why I try to continue to put myself in situations where I'm brushing up on the knowledge that I learn and the experiences I learn in the military, because I don't want to lose it. Because if you don't use it, you lose it. I was once so proficient in Spanish that the Army trained me and sent me to Special Forces Language School to learn Spanish. I was so proficient that I got paid extra proficiency pay by the U.S. Army. I was very fluent. After 10 years of not using it, I can pick up things here and there. I can read Spanish. I can understand. I could survive in a Latin American country. But I cannot converse like I once could, because you lose what you don't use. And that's the only way that I can reconcile this in my mind, is that she was one of those people who, I don't need to do that. I've been here for 26 years. I'm an expert. I'm the trainer. I don't need to do this. You guys do this. I'm going to go smoke and joke over here. I don't know if that's the case. I really don't. I hate to speculate, but in my mind, I'm like, how could that happen? How could this be? How could this young man be dead because of this stupid mistake? Get to the point of where, you know, people online and everywhere else, oh, he's a horrible criminal, a thug, he's a felon. No, he's not a felon. By the way, I understand it is, yes, he was charged with a felony. It was a rather serious felony involving a firearm. I believe he was burglary with a firearm, and the warrant that he was on, he didn't have the warrant. He had taken care of, or he was in the process of taking care of the more serious charge of the felony, had not been guilty, had not been pled guilty or found guilty of anything. So what happened to innocent until proven guilty in a court of law? And then they say, well, you know, the warrant was a misdemeanor for carrying a weapon without a permit. Now, these same people that are always spouting off about the Second Amendment and how the government has no right to infringe one bit on our Second Amendment rights, which I happen to agree. Well, why aren't you saying that now with this guy? Right? You know, you see what I'm saying? Like, if the guy was white and the guy was wasn't just shot and killed by a police officer, you would call BS when you say, oh, he had a misdemeanor warrant for carrying a weapon without a permit. Who is the government to say that you have to have a permit to have a firearm? That's preposterous. I believe in the Second Amendment. What part of shall not infringe do you not understand? Now, those very same people that would be saying that in one breath about somebody else, about themselves, will not give that same standard to this man. The fact that I said man, another argument that I got into was that he is a child. He was 19 years old. He just turned 20 years old. Yes, technically, that is a legal adult. As a 34, 35, about to be 35-year-old man, I look back at myself at 19 or 20, and I was a kid. The guy was a kid, okay? He was a kid. So, in the same breath that these people are defending Officer Potter and say, for Christ's sake, she made a mistake. She doesn't need to go to prison. It was an honest mistake. It was a stupid mistake, but it was a mistake. She didn't mean to kill him. Give her the benefit of the doubt. She's an officer. She's an upstanding citizen, right? Now, but when it comes to the 19 or 20-year-old child, in my mind, he made a horrible mistake. He panicked. He did something very stupid. Okay? He ran away from the cops. He resisted arrest. He got in the car. He tried to get in the car and drive away. Very dangerous. Okay? But he was 19 or 20. Okay? Why would you be wanting to give the officer the benefit of the doubt and say, oh, she just made a mistake? Have some compassion for her. And not have the same for the 19 or 20-year-old child. I just don't get it. What is different here? The only thing is that he's black and she is white. Now, I'm not saying that that is overt or explicit racism. I'm saying that the way you think about those things in your mind, if this is you, not most of my audience I know don't think that way. But what I'm talking about is these people that I'm doing battle with online. Is that not an implicit bias? I mean, be honest. Why are you so willing to give this upstanding citizen, this officer, this 26-year veteran, the benefit of the doubt? Why are you so willing to give her your compassion and your empathy and your understanding and your forgiveness? And in the very same breath, demonize and stigmatize and criminalize Dante Wright. Because he made a stupid mistake? He didn't grab a gun. He wasn't trying to kill anybody. He had a misdemeanor warrant, for Christ's sake. Yes, I understand that he was being adjudicated for a more serious offense. Okay? I'm not saying that you should be not on guard when you're conducting this search or whatever you're doing, this arrest, because yes, the right thing to do in that situation was arrest him. He had a warrant. The warrant is a living document until it is served. He failed to appear. He should be arrested, right? And he should have complied. Nobody's arguing that. But what I'm arguing is he made a mistake. He's 20 years old. Maybe where he grew up, all he's known, he doesn't see the badge the same way that you and I would see the badge and see respect. maybe by the time he was 1 year, 1 or 2 years old, all he's known is the cops are in my neighborhood to thump on my uncles and my parents and my grandparent, whoever. How old was he when Mr. Castile was killed? 7 years ago. He was a child, right? See what I'm saying? Maybe we should put ourselves in their shoes. Is he a criminal? Yeah. But guess what? There's a book that I've been told about. I'm researching and I want to read. It's called Three Felonies a Day. And it's basically a study that says that a deep dive into the fact that the way our criminal statutes are written in America, any one of us could be written up and charged for an average of 3 felonies a day. It's all about how you charge and how you can shape the criminal statutes around somebody that you want to target. And that therein lies where another major issue of policing in America exists. The fact that these officers and prosecutors have so much discretion without any oversight, basically without any check on their power and their, you know, it's a known fact that everybody here listening, myself included, maybe I commit more felonies than 3 a day, you know, because of the nature of who I am, who knows. But on average, if they wanted to, if the cops wanted to, they could charge you with 3 felonies on average a day. Now, don't ask me what those felonies are. I don't want to get into that. I haven't read the book. I want to read the book. Joe Rogan was talking about the book the other day, which is very interesting. So yes, are these people criminals? Is George Floyd a criminal? Yeah, he's committed crimes. He's a convicted felon. He's whatever. He's a drug addict. Okay, I get it. But why can't we put ourselves in their shoes in these situations? Why can't we take this second to think, man, Dante Wright, 19 years old or 20 years old, he's a kid, okay? Maybe for the last 15, 16, 17 years that he's been able to recall his memory, he's only known horrible situations when it comes to the police. So maybe he was scared. Maybe he thought, crap, they're going to kill me. Who knows? Okay, maybe he wasn't trained, and I know he wasn't trained to deal with adrenaline. He wasn't trained to deal with high-risk situations like that. Right? He made a mistake. The 26-year veteran of the police force, she's definitely trained and more apt to deal with those situations. This brings me to my other point, or my next point. Many of these cases where you want to argue, well, it was a split-second decision, it was a life or death situation, it was a high-risk situation. Was it really, though? In a lot of these cases, the officer is the one who creates the adrenaline dump. They're the ones, by virtue of the way they approach the situation, they're the ones that create the life or death situation in their minds. They're the ones that create the tense situation. They're the ones that create these horrible lose-lose situations when, are they really warranted? I mean, why would you be pulling this guy out for a misdemeanor warrant and acting like this? She jumped out of her car at a 10. You know, you hear that, you know, a warrant from 0 to 10, and you have an escalation and a de-escalation. From the very moment she heard through that earpiece or through that radio that the guy had a warrant, misdemeanor or otherwise, she was jumping out, ready to take some names and kick some ass. She was there to thump on this guy, regardless of what the warrant was for or what the situation was. She hopped out of that cruiser, geeked up on adrenaline that she created. She could have came at the situation of, yeah, he has a warrant. Yeah, it looks like he might be somewhat of a dangerous person. I need to de-escalate this situation in order to create an atmosphere where everybody's calm. I can talk like a regular human being. I can explain to him what is happening. He likely knows what's happening because he knows. Well, I guess that's up in the air. They're saying now that he wasn't served with the, he didn't know when the court date because of the COVID thing, because of, he missed a Zoom court date, right? It's not like he was supposed to be at the courthouse and he didn't show up, but he was nonetheless given a failure to appear warrant. And who knows what happened, right? Lawyers today sometimes aren't the best. Probably has a public defender. He probably had a court date listed on Zoom and there was a breakdown of communication. Was it this guy's fault? Ultimately, yeah, he's 20 years old. He's a father, right? He knows that he's charged with this crime, a very serious crime of a robbery with a firearm, okay? Aggravated robbery or whatever it is. He should have been on top of things, right? A regular person a person that is on top of things, a person that is organized, a person that is trying to do the right thing, you know, they would know, okay, I have a Zoom court date here. I can't miss it, right? That didn't happen, okay? He's 19 or 20 years old. For whatever reason, maybe he didn't know that he missed. So when he was getting pulled over by these cops and pulled out of his car and all this stuff was happening, maybe he didn't know what it was about. I mean, maybe he didn't. Okay. Maybe he didn't know that he missed the court date. Right. My point is, why would Officer Potter jump out of her cruiser the way she did and go from zero to 10 without any need to do that, which is very ironic that another case in the news this week, the same exact thing happened. And this one is even, in my mind, not as worse because the victim wasn't killed, right? But an Army lieutenant, an officer in the United States Army, a Black man, a half Black, half Latino man, a lieutenant in the United States Army. I'm going to repeat that again. In full uniform. Is pulled over because the officer, it was nighttime, couldn't see the temporary plates in the window of the car that he had just purchased, right? He's a newly minted lieutenant. He's gone through officer candidate school, basic training. He's a new soldier. I think second lieutenants make very good money. He's on the right path in life. He's doing good things. It's very hard to become an officer in the United States Army. You have to have a college degree, for one. You have to go through a selection process. You have to go through officer candidate school and also basic training and everything else like an enlisted soldier. So the fact that he was a soldier in of any rank is very significant. But the fact that he's an officer, a lieutenant, is a higher thing, right? He, as a lieutenant, you're automatically in charge of men and women's lives in combat. You are tasked with leading a platoon, a company, whatever, right? You see what I'm saying? So he didn't immediately pull over in this very poorly lit area, pitch dark, because why? Well, guess who his cousin is or was? Eric Garner. Remember him? The other unarmed Black guy in New York that was killed by a chokehold because he was selling loose cigarettes. He was selling Lucy's. If you don't know what a Lucy is, Google it. They were bootleg cigarettes at that. They didn't have a tax stamp. Who knows, right? But it's the same thing. A counterfeit $20 bill, George Floyd loses his life. A Lucy cigarette or an untaxed cigarette, a bootleg cigarette, Eric Garner loses his life. Guess who this guy's cousin is? This Army lieutenant. What's his name? Lieutenant Nazario. It's Eric Garner's cousin. So when he sees lights behind him, lights and sirens, he's like, crap, I don't want to pull over right here. I know that there's a gas station up here that's very well lit. I'm just going to go slow until I get there for my safety, for the officer's safety, for everybody's safety. Now, I would do the same thing. Oftentimes, I drive from Phoenix to Safford and back. Lots of stretch there where it's pitch dark. There's a reservation from here to there. I believe it's my right as an American to if I'm pulled over to find a safe place to pull over. Now, if you're driving more than a couple hundred yards, you probably should call the cops or the dispatch while you're doing that and say, I'm not running. I'm just pulling to a well-lit place for my safety and for the officer's safety. Please bear with me. Please don't kill me. Whatever. I don't know if he did that or not. It doesn't sound like he did, right? He was probably focused on driving. He's probably had a nervous reaction and an anxiety reaction because his cousin was killed several years ago because he had some bootleg cigarettes. Okay. So he's thinking, crap, I need to at very least pull over in a well-lit place. So that's what he did. He drove to a well-lit area where he wouldn't be sideswiped off the road, where the officer could see his hands. He pulls up, he has his hands visible from the very beginning. The officer jumps out again from 0 to 10 in a split second, jumping out of that car as if this guy was a mass murderer on the run. Even after he sees that he's in the uniform of this nation, guess what he does? He starts yelling at him and giving weird commands and trying to confuse him and just escalating the situation, not just verbally. He pulls his pepper spray out. All the guy is saying is, officer, why are you pulling me over? He wouldn't even tell him. Come to find out, now that he's in this well-lit gas station, the license plate, the temporary license plate is visible, right? Sometimes these cars have more tinted windows. A stupid dealership would put the temporary plate behind that blacked out window, behind that tinted window. A good dealership would invest in the waterproof carrier that they can put it on where the actual license plate is going to go, so that the officers can see it. Nobody gets hurt. Nobody gets hurt. Nobody gets killed. The officers don't pull you over. Whatever. That didn't happen for this guy. Okay. Probably bought his vehicle outside of the base where he serves. And they took advantage of him because he was a new soldier. All of that happens. So, but the fact remains is he has his hands visible. He's trying to tell you that the reason that I drove a little ways is because I didn't want to pull over in the pitch dark in this narrow road where we could get sideswiped by a car, not paying attention, where you might not be able to see my hands. But I'm showing you my hands right here. See, my hands are outside the window. I'm speaking to you with respect. I'm obviously wearing the uniform of my country. I'm a soldier. Okay. Or at least give me the benefit of the doubt. I might be a role player or a cosplay soldier. I might have just got done at the what's that stupid thing that people play? Airsoft tournament. Who knows? Okay, but at least, look, I'm not murdering anybody right now. Okay? Give me the benefit of the doubt. Instead, he comes out yelling at him, cussing at him, tell me, let me see your hands. But which he had his hands out. Get out of the car. Sir, why are you taking me out of the car? I don't understand. Like, why am I getting out of the car? I'm scared. My cousin was just killed by you guys a couple of years ago. And maybe you heard of him, Eric Garner, right? Hands up, don't shoot. I can't breathe. Okay, where all this stuff kind of originated from. So in his mind, this guy's a young guy. Man, what did I do wrong where I'm being treated like this? Is it really the right of the officer to treat someone like that? No, it's not. So what does he do? He pepper sprays him. In the act of that, he's, what are you, a corporal, a specialist? Like, that should matter? No, actually, I'm a effing lieutenant. Like, it's just so unfathomable. We're kind of running short on time, and I'm getting a little heavy and ranting here. I'm going to take a short break, and I'm going to kind of button all this up and bring this podcast home. But you can see where my... How frustrated I am with all of this. Thank you for being here, the Come This Far podcast, Chris Taylor. We will close this podcast out here after this short break. Thank you so much. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. I'm your host, Chris Taylor, and we're going to kind of button this up and close down this podcast here. You can tell that I'm very passionate about this. I'm just so sick and tired, man. I'm sick and tired of seeing these things happen. I'm sick and tired of the people who are so afraid to be labeled as anti-law enforcement. I call them the "no matter what you do, back the blue" crew. They act like they can't say anything even remotely critical of any police officer in any situation, or you can't say that you're pro-law enforcement. That's preposterous. That's so stupid. You can be pro-law enforcement and want them to be better, want better for us, right? You've heard a lot about the defund the police or abolish the police, which of course is preposterous, which of course is idiotic. Mind you, the actual people behind that movement don't really want to abolish the police or even defund the police. They name it that because they know that the low information people will take to the streets and will provide cameras and action and boots on the ground, passion and advocacy for the cause. What they actually mean, and when you listen to their proposals and what they want, that they want to reimagine the way that we conduct public safety in a way that is more fiscally responsible, in a way that is more, you know, safer for the officers, that will actually provide public safety to protect and to serve all citizens, right? That will limit the interactions that police have in situations like these, where Dante Wright didn't need to die, where Lieutenant Nazario didn't need to be pepper sprayed and be treated like that. This is what they mean, right? It's not. But when you hear anything and you try to have a conversation about anything like that, you're like, "Oh, you want to abolish the police? You're crazy." No. You know, let's have a little bit more nuanced, complex dialogue here, because that is what's needed. This is a very, very complex situation, right? But listen, I'm sick and tired of the analogy of, "Oh, it's just a few bad apples." Even if that's the case, right? If you're using that analogy, there's just a few bad apples, but look, that would never fly in an orchard, right? In an orchard, if there's a few bad apples all the time, they're over a long period of time, you're always having a few bad apples. You wouldn't just kick those apples to the side and say, it's just part of it, right? No, you would call in an arborist to diagnose and to treat and to remedy the situation by understanding the tree, right? Examining the tree. Because that is where the fruit is cultivated. That is where the apples come from, the good ones and the bad ones. But there's always bad apples laying around. You can't just always say, "Well, it's just the bad apples." You call in an arborist to look and see what the system is about, right? You break down the policies. You say, "Well, how much are you watering this tree? What nutrients are you giving this tree? How often are you doing this?" In the analogy of police, it's, okay, we have to look at this system. Who is this serving? Is it really serving our interests, public safety? Not really, because taxpayers are paying an exorbitant amount for public safety, for pensions, for all this stuff that goes into having a police department. And we're no less safe than if we just didn't have one, really. I mean, yeah, you're saying all that, you know, what about the murderers and rapists and the violent criminals? With reimagining the police force or public safety in America, that's exactly what we'd be doing. We'd be freeing up the officers to take care of actual criminals, actual drug traffickers, not the lowly addicts, right? Actual violent offenders. Not the people who you say, "Oh, he's a domestic violence because he bumped into his wife. Let's throw the book at him, right? You see what I'm saying? That there's it no longer becomes about statistics where a department has to make these charges appear so that they can have their stats. So they can say, well, you know, this was actually an aggravated assault instead of a misdemeanor or whatever, because if we show that we have more violent crime here in this area, we can get cool soldier gear. We can get Humvees and new rifles and tactical vests. We can pretend like we're soldiers when really you're creating a violent criminal out of somebody who is not a violent criminal. It's all too often that somebody who's labeled a violent criminal has that aggravated assault charge on their record. It wasn't aggravated assault at all, right? It's the fact that the officer came geeked out of their mind on adrenaline from 0 to 10 from the very beginning, like this officer in Virginia who pepper sprayed the Army lieutenant, or Officer Potter who jumped out of her car ready to take down the Unabomber in Dante, a kid that had a misdemeanor warrant, right? You see what I'm saying? You're creating these situations where public safety is not really providing any safety to the public. They're pretending to, they're caught up in this system. And a lot of them, the officers are not, they're innocent. The officers aren't there to be horrible, but they're caught up in a system that's broken. The reason that so many bad apples are apparent is that the tree is broken. We need to reimagine it. We need to replant it. We need to reseed. We need to find different ways that will serve our needs for public safety. One of the biggest ones is providing mental health and crisis response teams to go out to these situations. But really, the officers need to, think things about reimagining, right? Okay, you're pulling over this guy because he ran, he had a minor traffic violation. Then you look and see, well, he has a misdemeanor warrant. Am I coming out with guns drawn and I'm going to start yelling at this guy? I'm going to pull him out of his car. I'm going to create this situation where now I've put myself in the position where it's me or him, right? Of course, you're going to go home to your wife and children, or your spouse and your children at the end of your shift. But these situations that are happening, how many times is it the officer's fault that the situation is escalated? How many times could they de-escalate just by simply changing the way that they approach the situation? You're on guard. You're still tactically, proficient. You're still mindful of your surroundings. You're still, looking for threats, but you're not creating this situation where you are dumping the adrenaline into yourself because, something that with some training and some wherewithal and some life experience would show you that this guy is not going to kill me. This guy's not going to fight me. And if he does, I'm going to be ready. But I'm not going to get myself all amped up jumping out of this cop car thinking this guy is going to kill me. So I got to be on my game. I got to get my taser out when it's really my firearm, right? See what I'm saying? Before I jump onto the reimagining real quick, I read this article where the police chief in Virginia said that no apology was owed for the pepper spraying Black and Latino Army officer in Virginia. He said while he felt bad for the events of the traffic stop, how it unfolded, the police chief of the town where this happened said that he did not think the soldier is in need of an official apology. In response, Army Lieutenant Karen Nazario's legal team said Windsor Police Department Chief Rodney Riddle continues a false narrative of the case and blaming their client for initiating it. They said the video of the stop shows otherwise, that their client was nothing but compliant, respectful, asking questions. You're allowed to converse with the officer, right? Yes, you want to show them your hands at all times. You want to say yes, sir, no, sir, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. You want to be respectful. You don't want to be, you don't want to escalate the situation either, right? It goes both ways. Please do not take this as I'm an anti-cop. I'm just going to crap on these officers. No, it goes both ways. All too often, people are there to antagonize and to act stupid and to make things harder. But again, that's what you signed up for as an officer. You know that these people are going to be having the worst days of their lives when you are interacting with them. You're the one who put yourself in that career. You're the one who said you could do it. You're the one who said that you had the temperament to take care of this. So why now are you acting like, oh, it's unfair. They're, you know, he wasn't complying. He didn't do. Grow up, right? You're an officer. You have the burden of being the bigger person, right? You're the one that should have things under control. You're the one that should have the empathy and the compassion to be able to take care of the people that you swore an oath to serve and protect, right? Not the other way around. Now, we do need to respect officers. They do a very difficult job. The reason that I push for reform and push for reimagining the way that we approach public safety and crises, public health crises and epidemics and mental health crisis in our country is that yes, for the people, but also for the officers that shouldn't be dealing with these situations, that shouldn't be in these situations where they're undertrained, where they have no skills to cope with what's happening. They have no wherewithal. The other thing that I'll point on is that the ludicrous standards that takes to become a certified officer in every state in this country, right? And what I mean by that is a police chief in a city, say a small town, they might know somebody, they might see somebody, man, he'd be a great officer. He's been through a lot in his life. He's gone through some things. He's 26, 27, 28, 30. You know, he's married. He's been through some things in his life. Man, he'd be a great officer because, for one, he's struggled with some things in his life. He's a good guy. He would be able to connect with these people that we deal with every day. He'd be able to have some insight and some unique perspective. He's a veteran, say. You know, he'd be able to deal with escalation of force and de-escalating situations when they need to be de-escalated. He'd be tactically proficient. He wouldn't be out of his mind jumping out of a car because somebody didn't show him his hands right away. You know what I'm saying? But the way that the post standards are, the police officer standards and training to get certified as a police officer, to be hired by a department, to even go to the academy, you have to be so squeaky clean that in reality, nobody's that squeaky clean. So you're just hiding something, usually mental health issues. You game the system by passing the polygraph because polygraphs are stupid and they don't work. That's why they're not admissible in court, right? You have a psyche eval that's so easy to manipulate, right? I know people who are officers, close friends of mine, army buddies, that have a hard time getting a job in a major city like Dallas or Charlotte, North Carolina, because they had a divorce on their record, because they had been divorced, literally, and because they had been treated for or had sought some assistance with post-traumatic stress after returning home from a second combat tour, right? This is a friend of mine, a couple friends of mine who are police officers or try to be police officers, have no felonies on the record, have no criminal history. One of them was turned down by a major, he's a police officer in a smaller location, but turned down by a large department because, you have two divorces. We don't know what's up with that, but you know, we're not, we think something's wrong there. So we're not going to hire you. Right. It's like people get divorced. Wouldn't that give you more of a unique perspective on what regular everyday people are dealing with when you interact with somebody? Man, he's probably having a bad day because maybe he's going through a divorce. You know, maybe I can talk to him on a human level. Maybe I can de-escalate the situation a little bit because I know where he's at. Or at least I can attempt to put myself in his shoes. The all too often, the only people who become officers are people who have done nothing else in their lives, right? They do that because they want to train them and shape them. They want somebody who is young and brash and who doesn't have any bad habits or any history with anything, because we want to mold them into this super duper awesome trooper police officer. When it comes down to it, though, they're just out of their minds. They pretend like they're soldiers because they really wanted to serve, but they didn't have the guts to go when our country was at war. So they want to pretend like they're at war on the streets of America. That's one problem. The other problem is, this is a true thing. With the psych eval, they ask, well, why have you been divorced two times? Well, it says here that you sought some help in 2010 after coming home from Afghanistan. What do you have? What do you want of those post-traumatic service or post-traumatic stress soldiers? What's going on? Sorry, but we can't hire you. It's like, what? Are you serious? And not to mention people that maybe do have some criminal behavior, criminal history, a substance issue back in their past, but now they've been clean for, you know, many years. They're a more brighter person. They be able to deal with situations better. No, we don't want those people as police officers. We want this 19, 20, 21-year-old kid who's never been through anything in his life, who can't relate with anybody who's going through anything in their life, who will not put themselves in other people's shoes because they just haven't lived enough to do that, right? See what I'm saying? There's many issues with this system. We need the arborist to come in and to find out exactly what's wrong with policing in America, and we need to reimagine it. We need to chop down that tree. We need to have a coherent strategy for transitioning. We can't just abolish the police department in places like New York City and Minneapolis and Los Angeles and all these places. No, we can't do that because the real criminal-minded, criminal intent people would go crazy. It'd be a purge, right? I'm not talking about that. But we cannot continue to say that it's just a few bad apples, so let's move on. We owe it to the officers who do the right thing, who are there for the right reasons, who want to serve and protect, who do swear an oath, and who are there for the right reasons to do the right things at the right time to the right people, right? We owe it to them to let them do the job that they're supposed to do, that they want to do. They know who the major drug trafficker is in their area, but they can't go after him because they're busy dealing with this guy who has a DUI. You know, they're you know what I'm saying? I'm running out of time. I'm running out of patience. But I hope my point is getting across. It's not about abolishing the police. It's not about defunding the police. It's not about being a pro criminal and anti-cop. It's not about that. And to say that as a non-starter, that we can't even have a rational discussion about reimagining policing. And for these people who really want this to happen, these activists, stop saying defund the police. Stop saying abolish the police. Because what people hear on the other side of that is you're out of your effing mind. And they close off and they won't hear your actual good ideas for some reform. Quit saying that. I like how President Obama came out and said, we need to reimagine policing. And on this note, it's a quick article from the New York Times, how to reimagine policing and public safety that works for everyone. It says, a group of police chiefs, activists, and policymakers gathered to debate how to reform law enforcement in America in a time of unrest and upheaval. In a year of near universal upheaval brought on by the global spread of new disease, Americans also confronted a crisis that has long plagued the nation, racism and its brutal manifestations in policing. And I would add their implicit biases. When you say racism, you know, people get a wrong idea about it. It's not all racism. It's not overt racism. It's not, oh, I hate black people, so I'm going to target them. It's not about that, okay? It's about the analogy I made at the very beginning about implicit biases and how we can approach that. And the number one thing is to admitting that may exist in your subconscious, at least. You may have some biases that you want to deprogram from. It doesn't mean that you're a bad person. It doesn't mean that you're a racist person. It means that you're a product of your society, a product of your upbringing. It means that you may have some biases that you want to change. That's all that it means. The killing of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer who crushed the breath out of him for more than 9 minutes called attention to official violence again. This was written a year ago, actually, but it says it was updated March 5th of this year. So police brutality has been caught on camera before, but amid the frustrations of a pandemic and mass unemployment, the outrage has sparked mass protests across the country and reverberated around the world. And it continues on with Dante Wright and all these other things. The topic of police reform became a matter of popular debate, with one phrase in particular inflaming passions. As part of the Deal Book DC Policy Project, the New York Times convened activists, academics, law enforcement officials, and politicians to discuss public safety, racism, and the different things people mean when they say defund the police. Because like I said, most people who are serious about it don't mean defund the police. They say that because they know that those low information people, those people who are really angry and hurt and hurting, will take to the streets with those signs. It will bring attention to their cause. It will get things moving. I get the tactic. I don't agree with it because it's stupid. The participants were the former police chief for Seattle, Justin Blake, founder of Black Underground Recycling, and the uncle of Jacob Blake. He was the guy who was shot 7 times. He survived. They said he was reaching for a knife. I don't know where that case went. He's alive and I guess doing well. Kat Brooks is an activist and former Oakland, California mayoral candidate. James E. Craig was the chief of police for, or is the chief of police for Detroit. Brandon Descent, activist and Parkland shooting survivor. I think I remember him. He's the other one, not David Hogg, but the other guy who was very well spoken. Catherine Levine Einstein. Wow, Einstein. Associate professor at Boston University. Quentin Lucas is the mayor of Kansas City, Missouri. Chris Magnus, chief of police for Tucson, Arizona, close to home. Rod Rosenstein, we know him, partner at King & Spalding and former deputy attorney general. Moderated by John Elligon, the New York Times correspondent covering race. Okay. A striking and strikingly common theme emerged from formative encounters with the police. To begin, each panelist described a personal meeting with the police that proved influential in their lives. Notably, the police chiefs all recalled informative injustices that would shape their work, revealing a kinship with the activists who are seeking or working to change their profession. Chris Magnus, Tucson's police chief, was a teenage activist supporting a farm union boycott at a grocery store when he was handcuffed and put in the back of a police car. Although store workers had physically threatened the boycotters, it left me with a very bad taste, Mr. Magnus said, Chief Magnus. It caused me to think how I really wanted to treat people differently, and it had an influence, that's for sure. Carmen Best, Seattle's retired police chief, saw a family member handcuffed and arrested at home when she was a teenager. It was pretty shocking, she said. So that was my first encounter and certainly made me think about, you know, my place in the world and how we are viewed when we interact with the police. Detroit's police chief James Craig has spent more than 4 decades in law enforcement, but his first weeks on the beat in 1977 were not auspicious. What I was met with was my partner, who probably was a 25-year-plus veteran who was white. He says, "You're not going to drive this police car. You sit over there. Don't talk to me. Don't touch the radio. I don't want you here. All you need to do is just sit there and be black." That was my welcome to the Detroit Police Department, and I thought, this is absolutely not something I want to do. Wow. For the activist Justin Blake, who had been a college athlete, a chance meeting with the police after a party his freshman year turned violent and changed the trajectory of his life. He was beaten and arrested and spent the next year and a half fighting felony charges while nursing his injuries. That would have put us in jail for 45 years if we lost the case, he said. It was a big dent in our football career. I don't know if he's talking about himself in that context. We? Huh. Maybe there was another person with him. Similarly, the activist Kat Brooks discovered her calling as a young woman after an arrest. Her white ex-husband beat her, but Miss Brooks, who is black, ended up in jail. The experience informs her quest to find the places in our communities where we can disentangle ourselves from law enforcement, where we have community care and response to the community crisis as opposed to a badge and a gun. Defund the police means different things to different people. The participants also provided their perspective on the contentious phrase defund the police. I think abolishing is not practical because there's violence that needs to be addressed. You need law enforcement. But I think maybe refunding, your focusing on where the money is spent and how it's spent. I would agree with that. Chief Craig supported that contention, arguing that a tailored approach that meets the needs of each community is most appropriate. I agree with that as well. What works in New York City or Chicago will not work in Safford, Arizona. I get it. Should have autonomy, should be able to do what you need for your city, for your state, for your locality. There tends to be the sweeping one size fits all, defund the police. Where's that coming from? As the municipal police department, who do we work for? We work for the community. What does that community want? I can tell you very candidly, here in Detroit, people, especially in the most disadvantaged neighborhoods in our city, absolutely do not want defunding of the police. No, they want protection. But just because they're black and live in a ghetto doesn't mean that they should have less protection or less public safety than the people who live in Bloomfield Hills, which is a rich, affluent neighborhood outside of Detroit. Anyway, I thought this was going to be a little different. It's just talking about, to reinvest or refund or whatever the terminology is. We just need to have the conversations in a way that one side is not going to be on the defensive. Okay. When you say these things, you need to come at it as, no, I want to reimagine policing and refund and shifts and how we do things, training and otherwise, so that you police officers can do what you imagine you'd be doing when you wanted to become a police officer in the first place, which is getting real violent criminals off the streets, which is finding those murderers and those rapists and those major drug traffickers and everything else, not creating that false sense of public safety because your department needs the stat, right? You see what I'm saying? You talk to police officers, and I do all the time. I have very close friends. The best man at my wedding is a police officer, and they say the same things. Man, we do want change. We do want reform. We do need to reimagine what we're doing here because what's happening is not working. But you say that even as an officer, then your brothers in blue are going to say you're siding with the enemy. So there's give and take on both sides, right? And really it shouldn't be one side against the other. We're all a community. We all need to discover what we need to do to tackle this. I hope that I brought a little bit of my perspective into this. I hope that I wasn't too jumbled. I hope that I wasn't too ranting and raving, but I am just so sick and tired of this same book, same story over and over again. Excuse me, different book, same story. How many times are we going to criminalize and stigmatize and demonize the unarmed man or woman that's shot by police and give the officer the benefit of the doubt? Why can't we give a little bit of that same compassion to the victims? Why can't we give a little bit of the same compassion to everybody? Why can't we just find what we need in this 21st century with all the things that we're dealing with, mental health, mental crises, drug epidemic? We need to help these people. We need to help the police as well. We can't continue down this path. It's not just a few bad apples. There's the overwhelming number of police officers are good apples. But why are we continuing to let them grow on the tree that produces so many bad apples? We need to have an arborist come in and diagnose and treat the issue. And if that means we have to uproot that tree and replant it somewhere or reseed, that's what we have to do. But we should do it in the benefit of the officers and the citizens that they swear an oath to serve and protect. Thank you for listening to this Come This Far episode. Come This Far with Chris Taylor. It's a little bit of a longer episode. I apologize for that. I will see you after my trek from the mountain. Hopefully I'm back next week. If I'm not, look in the obituaries for a hiker that got lost and never came home. That's not going to happen, though. All right, guys. Thank you for listening. See you next week. You're listening to the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor.